Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Katie Meyer in for Scott Lamar today. My first guests are two reporters who have been covering a sweeping grand jury report on sexual abuse by clergy in six of Pennsylvania's eight Catholic dioceses. They're both reporters in the Capitol. Angela Columbus of the Philly Inquirer and Liz Navratil of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Guys, thank you so much for coming on. For the listeners, we welcome your questions and comments. Call us at 1-800-729-7532, or you can send an email to smarttalk@witf.org, and you can also leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we're Smart Talk WITF, and again, phone number is 1-800-729-7532. So guys, I feel like this has been going on for a while, but it's really only been about a month or so that this reporting's been going on intensively. So Angela, can you give me just a little bit of background? What do we think is in this report, and you know, where to come from, and why do we not have it out yet?
Right. So it's quite a long story. There was an investigation by the state attorney general's office into alleged clergy sexual abuse. And as you mentioned, six of the eight dioceses in the state. And the investigation actually began in, we believe, in the spring of 2016 and continued through the spring of this year. At that point, the grand jury that was hearing evidence in the case produced a lengthy report. We've had descriptions of almost 900 pages long, which documented this alleged abuse. And what we know from various court documents is that it looks at allegations of child abuse, it looks at allegations of endangering the welfare of a child, and it looks at allegations of obstruction of justice, meaning they're looking at both alleged abuse by Catholic priests as well as alleged cover-up after that abuse occurred.
Gotcha. And now, you know, there are certain things we know about this report. We've been, you know, chasing various filings that have been coming in over the last several weeks. As we mentioned, it's not out, and there's specific reasons for that. Liz, what is holding the report up at this stage?
So we know there is a group of current and former clergy members whose names remain out of the public view at the moment, and they have challenged the release of the report in its current form. They have a couple of different arguments. Some people have raised issues about whether medical records, for example, were properly included or referenced. One of the most common arguments we've seen is that folks have said that they believe that their right to their reputation under the state constitution would be violated by including them in this report.
And that's sort of an interesting component to all this, that we have in Pennsylvania the right to your reputation. So, like, Angela, legally, how is that used usually?
This is kind of going to be a really interesting challenge, because what we're going to see is the court, the state Supreme Court, is going to actually have to rule on that very issue. But I think what is more interesting from a legal standpoint is that the petitioners in this case are saying that the process of the grand jury, that the process that it used, in effect, is unconstitutional because it denies them the ability or due process and the ability to question evidence against them and the ability to throw out potential evidence that doesn't meet a certain standard that you would see in a criminal type case. In this situation, what we have is the statute of limitations on these alleged crimes has run. So the grand jury cannot produce a report that recommends criminal charges. It can only produce a report that documents what witnesses have said, and obviously backed up by records that were kept by the church and other documents that we don't yet know. So that is at the heart of this legal challenge, which is the process that the grand jury undergoes to produce this type of report. And critics say that once this report is out, that's it. There's no follow-up process. It is the last word in effect on what occurred.
So essentially, these people are not charged criminally, but their names are going to be tied to this thing forever if it does come out. So now there have been, and this is the reason why I believe the court, you know, initially held up the report. We were first expecting it to be out maybe last month, but they first kind of stopped it for additional, you know, hearings. So isn't this, you know, them getting their say in that?
Yes and no, yeah. Because I mean, if you talk to any lawyer in the defense bar in particular, right, they will tell you that in a regular criminal case, the grand jury process is essentially the start of the process. That once a grand jury recommends criminal charges, you go through this lengthy process that may or may not include a trial at the end, during which you get to question everything that prosecutors put on the table. And here, you don't have that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. And now, Liz, there are, you know, different people on different sides of this thing making very, very strong arguments for and against releasing this report. So on the side of, you know, not releasing, you have these clergy, you have their lawyers. On the side of releasing, who do we have?
The state attorney general has said he would very much like for this report to come out.
Strong words from him, yeah.
Their office so far has said, you know, look, these people have an unfettered right to respond to a report. They can put together some sort of response that will be released alongside it. And by comparison, the grand jury members are not allowed to talk publicly about what happened in the course of that investigation and the production of this report. We should also note that nine news organizations, including both of our newspapers, have also gone to court to try and get access to a copy of the grand jury report, mm-hmm. Arguing that they're required to release it under the law.
Gotcha. And but nothing on that so far.
No movement on that. The court has set aside the newspaper's petition essentially to get a copy, an unredacted copy of the report, as, you know, the best case scenario and the worst case scenario, a redacted copy of the report. But to add on to what Liz said, you know, in this case, we also have had the unusual benefit of hearing in court documents from the supervising judge, the judge who oversaw the grand jury.
Krumenacher?
Yes, Judge Krumenacher. And he, in this legal filing, it was essentially an order from early last month. He advocated for the public release of this report in using very strong words, and essentially saying that it is essential to prevent further abuse from occurring, that sunlight on this issue is incredibly important.
Mm-hmm. We also had a victim file something in court,
right,
saying, you know, they believe the state Supreme Court's decision to halt this has felt like another attempt to silence a voice that has long been silenced by the church.
Mm-hmm. And those are publicly available, all these filings. If people want to, they can read them. How can they access those? It's kind of tough.
That's a loaded question.
The state Supreme Court on its website has a cases of public interest tab where you can see select portions of the filings. Much of the information from these cases, though, still remains under seal, which is part of why what we know is so limited at this point.
Right, right. We have a question in from a listener, and I think this is a good one because we mentioned before the statute of limitations has run on most of these. So the question is, what is the time frame of this investigation? This person says they've heard it was about incidents that occurred 40 years ago. Or is it about incidents that are recent?
We believe that the investigation itself covers decades. Yeah. I have heard roughly 7 decades, but I do not have any indication as to how many are from that far back versus how many are more recent.
Right.
I think that's one of the things that we probably won't know until we see a report.
So, question asker, we would certainly like to know. But I think it's fair to say it's probably a pretty wide span.
Yeah, there's a roadmap essentially that has been carved in these types of investigations from previous reports, including one that was released in 2016 by the state attorney general's office, which looked at alleged clergy abuse in the Altoona Johnstown diocese. And if you look at that report, the abuse definitely stems back, 40, sometimes 50 years.
Right. And what is the statute of limitations on these cases?
So for civil cases, which is, we can talk about that, it is up to age 30. Mm-hmm. And for criminal cases, it is up to age 50. And
of the person who was abused.
Yes. Okay. And what victims or survivors will frequently tell you is that it often takes them many, many years to come to terms with what happened to them, particularly older survivors who grew up in a different generation where these were things that you just did not publicly speak about. And there has been a lot of discussion in the state capitol about statute of limitations reform or making changes to it to allow these survivors to file civil suits. That's really what the fight is all about in the legislature.
Gotcha. And now I want to bring it to the legislature because we have had over the last several years some pretty concerted efforts to change the way that we handle these things, specifically from a Representative Mark Razzi, who himself is, you know, a survivor of sexual abuse when he was a child at the hands of a priest. Where is that going? What are they asking for, first of all?
So what we saw in the last legislative session is that they were asking for the statute of limitations to be extended to include to capture more survivors and allow them the opportunity to file suit. What you're seeing in this legislative session is legislation that proposes a 2-year window that is open to anybody and allows them to file suit in that window. It is a very controversial issue. It is has been fought tooth and nail by both the insurance industry, obviously, and the Catholic Church and its lobbyists, who believe that it will bankrupt parishes and will lead to essentially making parishioners currently pay for the sins of things that happened, of people who conducted these things many, many years ago.
But then on the other side, you have people who say this is just really needed closure for people who have been dealing with this stuff for a really long time. And now, so we've seen some sort of back and forth on who supports this, who doesn't. Crucially, right now, we have a House leader who formerly did support extending the statute of limitations, rescinding his support. Liz, what happened with that?
My understanding is that Speaker Mike Terzai has withdrawn his support for this effort, which is being led by State Rep Mark Razzi.
Right. And that's according to Razzi.
Yes, according to him. Now, what's going to be interesting is when this report comes out, you know, it contains 6 dioceses, but the other 2 that aren't included have already been investigated separately. So you could potentially have this new political climate where every legislator, their home diocese has been covered. So a lot of people are checking to see if that provides new momentum for these efforts. But that being said, the legislature isn't back until late September, I believe.
And then it's only for like a handful of days, like 10 session days or something. So there's not a whole lot of time for them to finish this thing before the end of the year's session. So now, where we stand right now. We've had a recent filing, pages and pages and pages of filings that you guys had to deal with over the weekend. What's the latest? Where do we stand right now, Liz? I know you've read a lot of that.
Yeah, we read a lot. I mean, it was hundreds of pages of filings across the various petitioners.
Happy Friday.
Exactly. A lot of these court filings are coming out between 4:30 and 5, and we expect potentially some more documents today. There were some interesting nuggets in the set from last week. A lot of people noted that one filing strongly suggests that there could be more than 90 offenders in the Pittsburgh diocese alone, which would be something like twice the number previously publicly released, if that figure is indeed confirmed.
Gotcha. Go ahead.
Yeah, and the state Supreme Court has set a very rigorous schedule of arguments in this case, which is a public indication that they don't want to let this issue linger. So I do believe, you will see some sort of decision by the court, perhaps even early next month.
Mm-hmm. And just again, to remind people of the scale of this, it's thought to be maybe one of the most sweeping, the largest reports of its kind in the country. And I mean, we've already seen it's 6 of 8 dioceses, not because 2 dioceses didn't have any problems, but because they already had reports done on their own. These are expected to be even bigger potentially.
Yes. And if you talk to victim advocates, they will tell you that with this report, you now have a panoramic view of clergy sexual abuse in the state, and that has not happened in any other state in the country where that has multiple dioceses like Pennsylvania.
Yeah. And so, but we don't, so maybe 90, over 90 in Pittsburgh alone, possibly more. So we're talking about maybe hundreds and hundreds of people implicated in this. Liz and Angela, anything else you guys want to add on this? Anything else you're looking at in the coming weeks?
On this front, it does appear from some of the court filings that it will not just look at people associated with the Catholic Church, but potentially local public officials and also community leaders is what we know from those documents. So it is potentially going to be a very devastating look at this problem.
Mm-hmm. All right. We're going to go to a break. When we come back, some talk on Harrisburg's fiscal issues. But Angela and Liz, thank you so much. And you can read their reporting from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and the Philadelphia Inquirer. Welcome back to Smart Talk. I'm Katie Meyer and for Scott Lamar. In the second portion of our show, we're going to look kind of closer to home. We're going to look at Harrisburg's finances and some recent changes and how the mayor wants to handle a pretty significant deficit that the city is dealing with. There's a legislative angle to this, and it goes back many, many years. So here to sort of contextualize this issue and update us on the latest is our own Emily Previty, our Keystone Crossroads reporter here at WITF, and Lizzie Hardison, a city reporter with The Burg. Guys, thank you for coming.
Thanks for having us, Katie.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. So now, Emily, I want to start with you. So your reporting on Harrisburg's fiscal issues actually goes back to before you worked at WITF.
Correct.
When you worked at Penn Live. Now, it all starts with an incinerator, which just seems sort of like an interesting way to get into this. But what exactly happened with this?
Well, that is a long story. So
yeah.
Maybe we can
Very
start with an
story.
Overview and get into the details throughout the conversation. But I mean, really, it goes back to before the incinerator and the fact that a lot of the property in Harrisburg is tax exempt. So the city, being both the state capital and the county seat, has a lot of government and nonprofit landowners, many of them. And, you know, that sort of puts it and other cities like it in a position where they're kind of scrounging for revenue. And so the inception of the incinerator was, you know, here's a way where we can maybe generate some of our own revenue, make up for that. And there were new regulations for air quality issued by the EPA, and the facility had to be retrofitted, improvements had to be made to meet those new regulations. And basically, the project had a lot of debt tied to it, and the city ultimately couldn't make the payments. So that's a very, and that was like $360 million. Mm-hmm. That's a very broad overview of how this all happened. We should also know that there was no performance bond on the project, which would have held the private contractor, Barlow was the name of the company, somewhat, held them responsible for project failures and delays and things like that financially. But because there was no performance bond, it did all fall back on the city, which had guaranteed a lot of the debt.
Mm-hmm. And it was millions of dollars over budget. It took longer than it was expected.
Exactly.
Yeah. So anyway, long story short, the incinerator became sort of a black hole for the city. And how much debt did they end up with? Hundreds of millions of dollars.
Right. So there was $340 million, $360 million, tied to the incinerator. And then there was around another $200 million, part of which was tied to the parking garages in the city. Mm. And then there was also, smaller amounts of money that they owed to some individual contractors, a couple of million or tens of millions here and there. And on top of that, you know, when you're looking at what they had to pay off, right, what they had to issue debt in at the end of 2013, what that debt was issued to pay off also included $16 million in fees owed to the lawyers and other professionals who were involved in structuring the deal. So that's important to throw in there, too.
So I guess long story short, tons of debt, very little way to pay off of it. So that was when Steve Reed was the mayor. He'd been the mayor for a really long time. He left and there was also stuff to do with he had improperly taken some artifacts from the city that were worth a lot of money that he was using as collateral. Anyway, he exited. A new mayor, Linda Thompson, came in, and then Eric Papenfuse next, and he's the current mayor. And now, you know, since then, we have made some progress on the debt, right? Since the Reid administration,
right? So, we should note that there were warning signs as early as 1996.
Okay,
that the incinerator, you know, that its revenues were not keeping up with projections, that in, you know, post-debt collapse documents and analysis, you know, have said was just these projections were pretty much fantasy, that they were like really overzealous, super optimistic. And there were some projections along the way that were more conservative and suggested more caution or taking a different course, maybe not, you know, maybe not following through with the retrofit or doing something different. And those were ignored, essentially. So basically, once Reed left office shortly thereafter, the city defaulted on its debt. There was a state takeover of the local government. That's the first and only one in Harrisburg or in Pennsylvania's history. It's a, called a receivership, but it's essentially a state takeover. And basically, so there's been progress made on the debt in that there were $1.1 billion of new obligations issued to take care of the old debt. But there's new debt to pay. Now, the structure is smarter, according to the people who put the deal together. I'm not saying that it's not, but, you know, it's 40 years of repayments, and a lot can happen in that time.
Right.
So, yes, the old debt is paid off. The debt that caused the city to almost, you know, essentially declare bankruptcy, that's paid off. But there are 40 years of obligations that need to be paid. The hope and the expectation is that revenues from the city's parking system will cover some of it, from the incinerator will cover some of it.
Taxes.
Well, Lizzie can speak more to that aspect of it, but yes. And that's also tied into the city's like structural deficits that were going on, and that's a little bit different than the debt, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. Okay, so some progress, but we're still saddled with a lot of debt. Do you know, Lizzie, like what the current figure is?
I don't. I mean, as Emily said, we're only, what, 4 or 5 years into basically a 40-year payoff period.
Yeah.
I don't know the total figure of debt we're still paying down. And I wish I could tell you exactly what percentage of our yearly budget is going into debt service. But as Emily said, operating in the background of this the whole time and really the reason for the incinerator fiasco in the first place is the city was trying to basically put a Band-Aid on a long-standing structural deficit that really comes from shifts in population, people moving out of the city, and the city still being tied to the third-class city code that sets, you know, determines how we can set our tax rates.
Right, and caps the millage rate at, like, you know, a figure rather than, say, a percentage limiting tax increases to a percentage annually once you hit a certain rate, unless you're in Act 47 and have a waiver, it's limited to that rate.
Right. And so now let's back up a little bit because I want to get into, I think, the really interesting part of this, what's happening currently, is our relationship to Act 47. So Act 47 is the Financially Distressed Municipalities Act of 1987. And when did we, I had that in my notes, when did we enter that? It was under, I believe, Linda Thompson, or was it under Eric Pattinson?
It was Linda Thompson. I want to say it was 2010.
2010. And then we adopted a strong plan, which is the recovery plan.
That was in 2013.
Yeah. Okay. And so when Papenfuse came into office, that was in 2013, a lot of his campaign was really dealing with the question of should we declare bankruptcy or go into a recovery plan. And his main competitor... So he was running against the incumbent Linda Thompson. He was running against Dan Miller, who's now the city treasurer. And so Miller, his campaign really focused on bankruptcy, and Papenfuse focused on recovery, and a lot of people credit that strategy with his win. And the city has really made, they've stuck to the recovery plan. The most recent state report about our finances said that. They've really cut their staff. They've imposed austerity. There's this perception, I think, among some members of the legislature that there's still profligate spending in Harrisburg, but there really isn't. And, I mean, we haven't had a full complement police force in years. We won't as long as we're under Act 47. Our staff at City Hall is very lean. Our services are very lean. And so there's really very little the city can still cut. So they've done good management. They've managed their money well and budgeted well, run surpluses every year that Papenfuse has been in office. But now they are looking at exiting Act 47, but it's not as simple as just exiting.
Right. And so under, you know, the mm-hmm. Act 47 plan, we would have to exit in 2021 unless we renew it and stay in there.
Well, we have to exit in 2021 no matter what. Okay. Because I think in 2014, the legislature passed this new rule basically capping the amount of time a city can stay in Act 47. So mm-hmm. when Harrisburg entered, it was under the assumption that we could stay in as long as we needed to, because
right.
that was the law. And then a few years later, the legislature imposed a limit on how long cities can stay in, and that affected the cities that were currently in Act 47 as well.
Gotcha.
And so we have to exit by 2021 no matter what.
Okay.
So, and I don't know if that you would know better because you're covering it day to day, but does that assume, you know, there's the 5 years that's kind of ideal, but then there's room for applying for an extension? So does that
yes.
assume max extensions 2021?
Yes, okay. exactly. Mass so the max extension. Time, I should say, is 8 years you can stay in. You've got that 5 year initial period that we're now closing in on because we adopted the recovery plan in September 2013. So September 2018, it expires. And then what we would adopt next is a 3 year, essentially, exit plan that is our extension, our one-time extension.
Gotcha. And now, so exiting Act 47, a lot of changes go along with that. But on a sort of basic level, it's seen as a decent thing for the city, right? There are some benefits that are tied to this.
Yeah, the main one being autonomy mm. and no more state oversight. I guess the thumbprint of the state in Act 47 isn't that major at this point for us. They have to approve we have to submit our budgets to them. And now that we're going through the potential exit or renewal process, they do have a much bigger say in what we do with our budgeting. But we adopted the state recovery plan in 2013. We've been following that. But if we exit, then we get financial oversight. We have no more state oversight. And I've heard it said that it could benefit the city's credit rating. I don't know about that. But I also know that it would help their hiring and retention, because I know right now when it comes to hiring public safety personnel, it's very difficult for them to convince people to come on into a distressed city where their jobs could potentially be in danger or where, you know, their pay could be capped, especially when police officers are in very high demand and can get a job somewhere else.
Right. And I think Papenfuse has also said, listen, like being a not distressed city is good to attract businesses.
Yeah.
It makes us,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
look more economically viable.
Yeah. We're no longer a joke.
Yes.
The laughing stock of Pennsylvania.
Aw. Real quick, I want to take a quick diversion because we have a caller on the line. This is Linda in Hummelstown. And Linda, just kidding. Linda couldn't stay on the line. Linda says they raised the rates on the parking meters in the city and it discouraged patrons from doing business in the city. End result, they're hurting themselves with their solution. This kind of just all goes into how the city has been grappling with debt. Do you think Linda's correct in that assessment?
Well, unless someone's done an analysis that I'm unaware of, that it's really hard to say.
Right.
And
yeah.
the bottom line is that, sure, that makes sense. Not just increased parking rates, but also the aggressive enforcement of tickets, or you know, parking meters, ticketing, getting people to pay their tickets if they're late. The cost of them, I mean, $30, if it's not paid within 4 days, it goes up to 50.
60, I believe.
Oh, is it 60 now? It used to be 50.
Was it? I think it's 60.
I thought it was 50, but I've never let it get to that point.
Yeah.
But which is not to say I haven't gotten any parking tickets, because I have. And they hurt.
Yeah, I think we all have.
It's an avaricious parking authority, and they are
right.
hyper-vigilant.
Yes,
so,
they are.
Because the revenue is tied to, you know, they need that to repay the debt that was issued to mm-hmm. take care of the old bad debt that caused the city to become distressed and go into Act 47. Mm-hmm.
Right. So back to the debt, back to Act 47. So there are some benefits to exiting it from doing the, you know, 3 year exit plan that we have to now do. Mm-hmm. But
I won't say not from doing the 3 year exit plan, but from exiting Act 47.
From exiting.
And so it'd be better if we could just do that now, mm-hmm. because the 3 year plan, as we'll get into, would kind of be a catastrophe.
And we will get into that. But right now, so exiting Act 47 comes with changes to our taxing authority. And what
Correct.
Would, under the standard, you know, Act 47 exit, what would those changes be?
Well, essentially, Act 47 works by giving municipalities extraordinary taxing authority, but it's with the understanding that it's a temporary measure. And so, again, this gets into the, I guess, first iteration of Act 47, which allowed a city to stay in for as long as they possibly wanted. I think that the legislature believed that municipalities are basically abusing what was supposed to be a temporary privilege of hiking their tax rates beyond what's allowed in the state code. And so now we would have to basically surrender our extraordinary taxing power, which has allowed us to triple our local services tax. And so that's a tax paid by anyone who works in Harrisburg. And it's a way of getting revenue from our commuters, because Harrisburg has a population of 30,000 commuters who come into the city every day, use the roads, rely on the emergency services, but don't pay either property tax or income tax.
We also have an extraordinary number of, you know, tax-exempt properties,
yes,
because we're the state government.
Yeah, and so we do get a $5 million, it's not technically a pilot payment in lieu of taxes, but we get a $5 million payment from the state legislature for, or the state capital complex, gives us $5 million every year for providing fire and emergency services.
Mm-hmm.
It's just fire, because they have their capital police.
Now, has anyone talked about the option of, and this wasn't discussed very extensively, and it hasn't come up too much in some of the other cities I've looked at since, joining the Keystone Crossroads Project, but has anyone talked about the option of petitioning the court after they exit for the ability to tax at a higher rate? Because I think technically you can do that even if you're not distressed, but it doesn't seem like that happens very often.
So that was technically how we got our current local service tax and earned income tax. It was through the Commonwealth Court, a ruling from them that allowed us to set the tax rates at what they are. So the first, when Mayor Papenfuss first kind of raised the alarm bells about this exit and losing our taxing authority, I asked that question. I said, could we appeal to the courts for some kind of relief or maintain our taxing authority that they gave us in the first place? He said basically no. And then a week later, he said yes. So it seems that we could. Hypothetically, yes, I guess.
I've always kind of wondered that and never reported it out, but I've always sort of wondered, like, what's the history there? Like, have a lot of municipalities done it, or they did in the past and never got it, so no one bothers? I'm just not sure.
Mm-hmm. I don't know yet. And it'd be interesting to see if there's any precedents for that across the state.
If anyone knows, call in. So right now, though, we're exiting Act 47. We're going to lose that taxing authority when we do exit. Lawmakers are lobbying for sort of like a bespoke financial status under the state.
Basically, it would essentially allow Harrisburg, whatever form this comes in. So before the legislature adjourned for recess for the summer, there was going to be potentially a change to the state fiscal code that's passed along with all the bills every year before they adjourn, or passed along with the budget every year.
Sure.
But now we have a bill being co-sponsored by Greg Rothman from Cumberland County and Patty Kim, who represents Harrisburg. I haven't seen a copy of it online yet. It's not up in the library, but it's a bill that just codify Harrisburg's existing tax rates and basically give it an exemption from the third class city code. Because as the mayor has said to me before, Harrisburg, yes, it's a third class city, but it's the only third class city in Pennsylvania that is also the state capital. And so as a state capital with all this tax exempt property, it should have some special privileges in its taxing.
Mm-hmm. Do you know, it doesn't sound like there's very much precedent for this happening, because
not
we are the only state
of
capital.
Yeah. I mean, do you know about any other Act 47 exits? I mean, Pittsburgh is exiting.
Nanticoke, but that is very different, a very different municipality than all of the municipalities that I've covered their exits. I think like West Hazleton was another one. They're so small compared to Harrisburg.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
it really is a unique situation. We have a caller on the line. I want to get to her. This is Pam in Harrisburg, also with a comment on parking.
Okay.
Yes, I live at downtown Harrisburg on Green Street. The parking is deplorable. Mm. Anytime I speak to people outside the city, number one complaint, number one by far, is the parking. It's stupidly expensive. Mm. It's enforced to a point of being ridiculous, and even the residents are having trouble. And on top of that, opening a business in PA is a major, in Harrisburg, has so many loops and things to hop through. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Recycled Bicycle, a nonprofit trying to help the neighborhood, has been trying to get a building, but they have so many restrictions in Harrisburg. They're having problems.
Mm. Well, I mean, I think this, thank you, Pam, for your call. We appreciate it. And I think this kind of goes back to Harrisburg has had to make money somehow, and parking has been one of the ways they have come up to do it.
And also the city has had very little say in how those rates are set, because they basically, when they leased that system...
it's controlled by, like... a conglomerate of
interests
and entities.
When I talk to the person who manages Harrisburg's parking, he's in Atlanta. Like it's not a locally controlled system. And they have people on the ground who are enforcing it. But they work for this private company that's like a company and a company and a company and a global conglomerate of bondholders. Yeah. I don't know. but as far as parking as an impediment to business and economic development, I mean, I've heard a lot of people say that, and recently a group of restaurant owners downtown worked with the city and the county to basically waive parking in the downtown improvement district. So if you go south of State Street, parking is free now after 5. Mm. And the Berg's editor, Larry Benda, wrote a report a few weeks after this went into effect. It went into effect in April, and he spoke to some restaurant owners, and they said that their numbers were improving, that more people were coming downtown. And I mean, I park downtown for council meetings, and it's nice to not have to, you know, I expense my parking, but it's always nice not have to worry about it, not, you know, if I forget to do it or forget to extend it, it's nice not have to worry about a ticket. So I'm definitely sympathetic as someone who lives and works and, you know, goes out and about in Harrisburg to not, you know, not wanting to pay these really high parking fees. But I don't know. I mean, maybe they're high compared to other places in the area. But it's also just because there, you know, there's limited real estate in Harrisburg in the downtown area for parking. You can only have so many cars.
Yeah, I mean, I did, and it was a few years ago, so it could have changed since then. But I did look at how the new rates and ticket fine costs compared to other cities in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And there are a handful that are more expensive, but most of them are like major cities such as New York and Los Angeles. So. Mm-hmm. It is, for a city of its size, quite expensive to park in Harrisburg. But I would also say that when I first moved here for the job reporting for PennLive and the Patriot News, there was no parking deal. The rates hadn't gone up. There was no enforcement of tickets. If you got a ticket, like, the wisdom was just don't pay it because you don't really have to, even though it was pretty inexpensive. But I would say that there wasn't, I mean, it wasn't so different in my mind as far as what was here for people, as far as amenities and stuff like that. And, you know, the city had already, as Lizzie alluded to before, had a problem retaining residents. You know, the school district was, you know, underperforming already, things along those lines.
Yeah,
and so there, right. And there were things that, you know, the state and the city, small things that they could have tried or done that they weren't doing to try to retain residents and encourage businesses to open up here, you know, like home buying incentive programs, for example. That's something that I think the city does now to a limited extent. You might know more about that than me, or they were considering it. The state could have gotten, you know, tried that too, to get state workers, encourage them to buy in the city to stabilize things and improve things. But they have never done that as far as I'm aware. Mm-hmm. And that is something that I reported on previously, like back when I was with PennLive. So
gotcha.
It's not just the parking is my point.
Right. Well, and the last thing I'll say about parking is I think that, as Ellie mentioned, the fact that there used to be really low rates and virtually no enforcement. I think that that's really the source of the sticker shock.
Yeah.
In addition to what is, I suppose, higher rates than neighboring cities.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really drive in neighboring in any other cities, so I can't really compare. But I can imagine that for a city in central Pennsylvania, the rates do feel very high.
For sure. We're going to go to a quick break. When we come back, we're going to get more into our newly announced fiscal crisis in Harrisburg. Welcome back to Smart Talk. I'm Katie Meyer, and for Scott Lamar, here with Emily Previty and Lizzie Hardison, two people who have covered Harrisburg's fiscal issues for some time and are now going to turn their attention to the mayor's recent sort of, I would say, extreme proclamations some people have said about the city's fiscal status and what's going to happen if we don't get a sort of a special taxing authority under our Act 47 exit.
Mm-hmm.
So, Lizzie, you've been covering this. What's Papenfew saying the situation is?
So, I'll frame it this way. So, a week ago, I think it was a week ago now, The state DCED issued their official, I guess, draft 3-year exit plan for Harrisburg.
Right.
And so that represents the state's position on what the city needs for recovery in the next 3 years before it has to exit Act 47. And that report has to be based on current law. It can't be based on hypothetical legislative changes. But it did say that the city should continue to lobby for special taxing authority. But it said if that doesn't happen, we have to prepare for what you'll be facing in 3 years, which would be surrendering your taxing authority and losing $12 million of revenue.
Right.
And
that's 20% of the city's budget.
Yes, that sounds right. And you'll see the number 11 million or 12 million floating around. I think it's like 11.8 million in revenue that we've really raised from our local service tax and earned income tax. But if the city lost that, then it would, if the city lost those tax rates, you know, if the legislature doesn't allow us to tax them indefinitely and if the courts don't offer us any relief, then we would have to cut that $12 million from our budget. And that is basically impossible because, as I said earlier in the show, the city has already really cut its staff and its operations down to pretty bare bones level. Mm-hmm. And so it would be really difficult for us to maintain our police force, our fire bureau. The state plan actually suggested, as one of many initiatives that the city could take to cut its spending even more, basically consolidating its police bureau with other municipalities in the region, which would just never happen. No one wants to deal with Harrisburg's public safety issues, which, I mean, it's a safe city, but it's as a city, it has, you know, a higher call volume, more incidents than neighboring municipalities.
Yeah, there are a lot of municipalities in Pennsylvania that rely solely on state police, but not usually of Harrisburg's size.
No. I mean, as Emily reported, those are usually tiny little
hamlets. Municipalities. Yeah.
So the city is basically facing a choice. It will continue to lobby for special taxing authority, and that lobbying effort will continue into September when the legislature comes back. But they have to adopt a plan by, as I said earlier, I think September 21st. And if they adopt the state plan, then they'll enter their next budget cycle under the assumptions in the state plan, which is you're going to lose $12 million in 3 years. So let's do it gradually and just cut $4 million every 3 years. $4 million every year for the next 3 years.
Okay.
Which would still be a big ask.
Right. And so now Papenfuse is basically saying this is impossible.
What is
his ideal outcome? And obviously a special taxing authority.
Yes, that's it. Because then, you know, the city would be able to, that would amend the city's structural deficit. And the hope really is that there is still a hope that these tax rates, that a lot of people say are really high, There's a perception that they'll just continue indefinitely, but the mayor does hope to lower them if we bring in more people, because essentially the problem with Harrisburg is that you have a very small tax base. We have 49,000 people. Many of them the majority of them live at or below the poverty line, and so we just have very few people who we can tax, and so we really need more people to move into the city to support services for the city.
Mm-hmm. And now, so are there any, you know, proposals floating around that aren't from the state about how to reduce spending? Like, are there any out-of-the-box ideas? Are there any ideas about how to increase revenues aside from just getting more people? I mean, it sounds like people feel like their options are very limited here.
Well, the state... Speaker Mike Terzai, who has kind of been the main voice from the State House on this, because he's the loudest.
He thinks they're spending too much.
He thinks it's a spending problem, but anyone in the city will tell you it's a revenue problem. And I think that most people who look at their budget would tell you it's a revenue problem, just because, as I said, they have a small tax base. And they serve many more people on a given day with infrastructure and emergency services than they tax.
Right. But has Terzai said anything specific about how Harrisburg could cut its budget?
I don't think so. No.
Okay.
Very surprising. Did you want... I mean, just, you know, bringing up the legislature and some of their criticisms of the way that the city's run. I mean, just to go back to how it got into this mess in the first place, and some of the legislative reforms that were considered and ultimately never went anywhere in response to the debt crisis. I mean, we talked about the tax-exempt property and the incinerator kind of being, like Lizzie said, a Band-Aid for this operating or structural deficit, the revenue generation that would have come from the incinerator. And then we talked about the fact that there wasn't a performance bond. We talked about the structure of a third-class city, which the legislature could control. They could look at changing the way tax increases are limited, so it's not just this arbitrary rate, but maybe a percentage increase, as is the case in other states. There are limits on what municipalities can tax. So if Harrisburg wanted to do a drink tax of 25 cents a drink, say, to help with things, they can't do that. That's not the case in other states. Atlantic City, New Jersey, for example, has long had, and I know they're not necessarily the poster child for responsible governance, but they, you know, it's a dollar a drink that goes to pay the debt on the convention center, for example. So just some of things like that. In addition to the fact that, you know, the laws on municipal debt, I mean, the rules were definitely bent. I don't know that if you could say for sure that they were broken, but there aren't a lot of teeth anyway in the laws for that. So it's almost just more of a monitoring. And DCED is so understaffed. Their funding's been cut. Their staff has been cut consistently over the past, I don't know if within this administration, but I know looking back from, you know, since Rendell through the Corbett administration, certainly, they just didn't have, they didn't have it then, and they probably don't have it now to really give a close look at some of these, you know, debt documents that come in that they're supposed to review.
Right. I want to take a call real quick. We've got a couple minutes left here. We've got Les in Harrisburg on the line. Les?
Good morning.
Oh, hi. How are you?
I just heard you say that a lot of your tax base is at or near the poverty level. And it seems to me that a lot of people like myself, say, don't want to move into the city because of the school system. I think if you concentrate on the school system, everything else will sort of fall into place. A lot of people want to live in the city, but, man, when you have kids, you got to go to the good schools.
Right. Les, thanks for your call. And I think that's, you know, a key challenge for a lot of families living in Harrisburg or around Harrisburg. The school system is notoriously not very strong.
Correct. And property taxes are increasing there, too. They levied a 3.6%, or they approved a 3.6 tax hike in their most recent budget. And I think that, you know, so goes the school, so go the city. But the mayor... So Harrisburg's school district used to be under direct mayoral control. And again, because Harrisburg is unique in many ways across the Commonwealth, that was the first arrangement of its kind in the whole state where a mayor basically controlled the schools. And now the city and the school district are separate entities, separate governance structures. And I think that a lot of people in City Hall share frustration that the district has not shown as much recovery in the past 5 years as the city has. And it does pose a problem for growth and sustained growth.
Gotcha. And is that, I mean, you said, Les said, this is probably one of the key issues keeping people from moving into Harrisburg, though. Is that fair to say?
I mean, I've heard that anecdotally.
Right, and it's one of those things.
Yeah, it's one
sort
of those things you just based on what you hear on the street. But yeah, and it makes sense because if you're looking at the schools as a good or a service, you can find a much higher quality service in neighboring municipalities, especially given what we pay in taxes.
Okay, we've got a minute or two left here. So, just kind of broad strokes, where do we go from here? What's next for the mayor, for the city, for, you know, legislative lobbying efforts to change our taxing authority?
So the state DCED will hold a public hearing next Tuesday, the 24th, in City Hall. I think at 5:30 p.m. about the recovery plan. They'll accept public comment I'll call it the exit plan. They're still accepting public comment on the exit plan. So if you're a Harrisburg resident, you can submit comments or appear at the public hearing. And then basically we're waiting until September to see what the final draft says and see what the legislature does when they go back in session.
Okay. And, you know, do we have any indication about what the legislature is going to do when they get back into session? I mean, you said it's not a very popular plan for Mike Terzai specifically.
It's I've been told that there is bipartisan support for whatever Harrisburg needs, and that it was blocked by leadership. So we'll see if we make progress with leadership.
All right. Lizzie Hardison and Emily Previty, thank you so much.
Thanks, Katie.